Welcome to the Money Control Real Estate Show, where we provide actionable advice from real estate experts, developers, and first-time homebuyers every week. I'm your host, Vandana Ramnani. Today, we have Amit Goenka as a guest. Amit is Managing Director and CEO at Nisus Finance, an alternatives manager in India with a focus on debt and mezzanine fund. Amit is here to tell us about real estate investment opportunities in 2022. Amit, a happy new year to you. To start with, tell us about the investment opportunities that await investors in 2022 when it comes to real estate, both for people with deep pockets and those who are not with so deep pockets.
Okay. Thank you very much, Vandana. It's a pleasure and privilege to join you today on this podcast. And a very happy new year to you and all the listeners here as well. To answer your question, Vandana, I think today's environment, and especially this year, allows investors almost unprecedented opportunities with a historically low cost of capital. We've seen that home loan rates have been slashed further and leverage limits have been increased. Home finance companies are in an aggressive investment spree, and investors have unprecedented opportunities, therefore, to invest into the sector, given the performance of the sector in the last 12 months. I also think that this space has now become more institutional than ever, making it a safer investment asset class than ever before, specifically after RERA, demonetization, GST, and more so now the pandemic, where only the able and the well-funded developers are offering products in the marketplace.
Okay.
We've also seen that in most micro markets, especially with the well-heeled developers, the product prices or the asset prices have increased by almost 12 to 20% in most markets, which means that there is a significant upside that has occurred and further likely to occur going forward, given that the demand remains unabated and there is still a significant amount of interest from first-time home buyers to enter into their own homes. On the back of that, we've also seen rental yields have gone up, where renting demand is also at a historical high. You know, typically in cities like Mumbai, we've seen 2.5% and 3% rental yields. In Bangalore, it's been 4% and 5%. That number has actually increased by 1 or 2 percentage points the last 6 months alone, where most people are wanting to stay in their own spaces, rent their own places, and be secure in their own environments rather than living in shared spaces. That also gives us a good investment opportunity. So any direct investment today, whether it's investing into mid-income homes, and or larger homes. And today the demand, honestly, is for slightly larger homes. In all our investments, we're seeing that larger 2BHKs and larger 3BHKs actually tend to get picked up and sold faster than some of the smaller and more compact assets and ticket sizes. So clearly, I think the demand is for slightly larger homes. And I think that's attractive both buyers as well as rentals in a very big way. I think also from a long-term value creation, plotted development and buying of land is a good idea, with enough infrastructure projects being announced, including road, ports, airports. So, for example, Panvel in Mumbai is offering great opportunities for home buyers and or real estate investors to buy plots with the development of that region. And so many other markets in Bangalore, Hyderabad, NCR, Pune, etc. So plotted development, especially when you have large developers like Godrej, Shriram, Purvankara, who've entered into this fray in these key micro markets, and they're good, you know, medium to long-term bets where the maintenance and upkeep is relatively low and provides for a good upside.
Okay.
Also, we've seen that, you know, compared to larger office footprints and office plates, the demand for small offices and co-working has also shot up significantly.
Mm-hmm.
I think most corporates are looking at a core and flex strategy rather than getting into one large IT park, which means owners of these small offices and co-working are today enjoying significant rentals from a floating population of occupiers, which are actually rented out by large corporates and not just by startups and smaller SMEs anymore.
Okay.
So that's a good investment opportunity today with co-working, which is, I think, here to stay for some more time. For those who are more passive investors in real estate, I think indirect investment products like REITs or AIF funds or real estate bonds, and even real estate stocks, I think will bode well. We've seen the stellar performance of macro tech developers on listing, and most stock market listed developers have actually shown an 80% or more increase in values over the last 12 months. In fact, the RE index has shot up by over 90% in the last 12 months. And if you look at the pipeline, if you look at the order book, if you look at the sales and delivery, as well as the total portfolio size that these developers are expected to come up in the next 2 to 3 years, I think the valuations are still below what they can actually achieve. So both stocks, bonds, AI funds, and REITs are also good indirect investment opportunities. And they're expected to continue to provide good returns post the pandemic, of course, in the short to medium term. And I actually qualify this post the pandemic because, you know, during the first wave or the second wave or now the third wave, there will be some start stop which will have some idiosyncrasies or volatility in the cash flows of developers and rents. But I think from a medium to long-term perspective, given that we're hopeful of overcoming the pandemic situation, I think there is a significant upside to be had for both small and large investors in 2022.
Okay. And what about investing in service apartments? I mean, there was a time when, you know, a lot of these developers had launched service apartments and some people made a beeline for this particular product because it offered assured returns. Now, do you think that, you know, this year, if there is one such product being launched in the market, people should actually go in for it?
Right, right. So you're right about that, Vandana, that service apartments were in flavor, you know, between 2016-17 till 2019, where people were looking at short leases, short-term residences, you know, staying in a place of work and then moving back to permanent residence after some time. Yeah. And even co-living, you know, for the purpose of education or working or, you know, temporary living. But honestly, I think the pandemic has disrupted a lot of that model. Okay. And people are now more averse to staying in service apartments or shared accommodations or co-living in today's times, given that work from home or study from home is likely to become a new normal for a significant part of most enterprises in India and worldwide. So I think return to office is happening in a very structured and in a very calibrated way, and which basically means that people have the opportunity to continue to stay in their own homes, in their own towns, or in their own rental spaces for longer periods of time and not work in out-of-service apartments or co-living or shared spaces. Also, the fact that the promise of these regular returns has been usually provided by the operators.
Correct.
And not necessarily is a function of the underlying asset class. So you're taking a risk on the operator who may not be a large branded player who's actually trying to monetize these assets by providing these rights, not necessarily the asset, but the rights of these assets to various investors for a return. I would be slightly more cautious about these asset classes in today's times because of the pandemic still not being out of our lives.
Okay.
I think there is a more directional movement towards having more permanent homes than living in co-living spaces. And third, I think technology has allowed us today more than ever to work and study out of anywhere rather than out of a particular location. And I think that is really why service apartments or co-living will tend to have some amount of pressure, both in terms of demand as well in terms of value.
Okay.
Whereas the upkeep cost has actually gone up because in a service apartment, the need for sanitization, the need for disinfectation, the need for, you know, keeping it sanitized and ready for multiple users is a bit of a challenge. And it was also a concern for occupiers. And therefore, that obviously increases the cost, but increases the volatility of returns. So I would honestly at this time not really go into the credibility of the operator, but look at the fundamentals of the asset class, which are very, very strong when it comes to own homes, when it comes to smaller offices, when it comes to some of the other indirect investment products, rather than betting on cash flows of a service apartment.
Okay. And Amit, what about, now that we have the third wave upon us, what happens to construction timelines? I mean, do you think these construction timelines will get hampered? And most important, will it be easy for developers to get construction finance going forward?
So I think an excellent point, especially something which plagues the mind of most investors or buyers in today's time, is the timeline for completion. And completion obviously is a function of availability of men and materials, as well as that of capital to complete the product. And both of them are actually under severe constraint. So we've seen that commodity prices have significantly shot up, and the larger boys are able to garner the support of the manufacturers when it comes to procuring materials on time and getting the labor and the equipment on their sites in time. Others tend to obviously suffer the lockdowns and suffer the construct of the third wave. But having said that, unlike in the first wave where there was a complete lockdown and a complete lull in the construction with the return of home of most workers, with the you know, gory pictures that we saw and the issues being faced by the construction population, I think this time around, most sites are fairly well prepared in terms of labor camps, in terms of sanitization procedures, in terms of COVID procedures. Most of the population has been vaccinated. Otherwise, they're not allowed to work on site. So I don't think the disruption will be very large, like we saw in 2020. There'll be some amount of delays of maybe 1 or 2 quarters. But I don't expect any significant amount of delays on account of the third wave, to be honest, purely from a construction perspective. Mm-hmm. When it comes to financing, again, I think if you saw the numbers of any housing finance company, whether it's SBI or HDFC, SBI, for example, has disbursed over 1 lakh crores over the last 2 quarters alone.
Right.
And most HFCs seem to be on a decadal high in terms of disbursements of new loans. So clearly, there's a lot of capital available from home finance companies for the purpose of sales and construction by selling to end customers. When it comes to pure construction finance from funds or banks or NBFCs, including funds like ourselves, I think we're obviously very, very selective. I think most NBFCs and banks have faced a slew of NPAs with the pandemic and due to consolidation and several other legacy issues. And I think the capital is now largely being targeted at the better branded and more well-heeled developers than the small and medium or disrupted players. So yes, there is a constraint when it comes to availability of construction finance for everybody, because the demand value of capital is over 2 lakh crores if you see annually for construction. But that is not the money available really for CF purely from banks, funds or NBFCs. The number is more like 80,000 to 90,000 crores. So we're looking at about 40 to 50% availability of capital compared to the demand. Now that means that, you know, that is the kind of, that is the amount of money being available, and that will leave away 50% of the players to not get the money that they need for the projects.
Okay.
So clearly, I think financial closure is important, and therefore buyers will need to do the due diligence, and it's become much simpler now post-RERA to be able to do the due diligence and understand who are the lenders, who are the banks associated with the project, do they have enough construction finance to complete it, what are the timelines, what are the sales been. So all of these things now being transparent and available in RERA makes it much easier for buyers and investors to figure out whether a project is financially closed and will actually deliver on time because of availability of capital or not. But having said that, let me also say that, to be honest, this 70,000-80,000 crores or 90,000 crores that will go is actually enough capital to meet the demand in the market. So wherever the demand is in the key micro markets, the key cities of India, I think there is enough capital to actually meet that demand.
Okay.
So bad products and bad developments or, you know, more futuristic developments won't get the capital. And that is not even necessary, I think. Mm. So at one hand, I think there is enough and more capital available. And if you see, a lot of foreign funds have come into our country to invest into housing projects. They, in fact, post-2020, the shift of capital, which was otherwise 80-20, 80% going towards commercial development and only 20% going towards residential development. So if you saw the FDI numbers, which are close to about $8 billion,
right,
almost 2019-20, almost 80% of that went to commercial real estate and only 20% of foreign capital found its way to housing. I think that ratio has significantly shifted to more like 50-50, which means there's a significant amount of foreign capital available today for the purpose of housing as well. We've seen World Bank do a lot of tie-ups in recent times. We've seen large foreign investors, whether it's Brookfield or KKR or GIC, etc., also, you know, start investing into housing projects. So I think purely from a global perspective, I think there is enough capital. Clearly, the world is facing a huge liquidity issue. There's too much liquidity in the market. But the attraction of that would obviously come only for the right players. So capital will be available, but for the right players, for the right products, in the right location. And that's clearly a point of discovery for any smart investor or buyer.
Okay. And Amit, what happens to the stressed asset funds? Are you expecting that at least in the forthcoming budget, you know, there would be an enhancement in the case of the Swami fund? And will these funds benefit home buyers who've been stuck with residential and commercial projects?
I think it's been one of the better years when it comes to resolving stressed assets in India. And I think that has really been one of the mega reasons for the mood to become more positive and vibrant for the housing space. We've seen a lot of resolutions through NCLT. A lot of the bad assets which were stuck with NBFCs have actually got resolved, with several other such NBFC portfolios being transacted. And going to larger funds, foreign funds who are now capitalizing these projects so that they can be completed and delivered. And Swami is one of them, who's got a 25,000 crore cash book to invest and de-stress these assets. And I think the performance of Swami also has been fairly overwhelming. Not only have they exited the first two projects by completing them, selling them, but I think they're on the way to similar sort of outcomes for several other projects. So I think the mood has become very positive for stuck projects and for stressed assets than there ever before. Because earlier there was no solution and there was no capital.
Right.
I think now with RERA offering solution, with IBC offering solution, and with home buyers themselves becoming more savvy, having tasted success with some of these, I think they're able to form groups and they're able to find the resolution, get the right developer or get the right fund, contribute the capital and get these assets completed. And I think RERA and the regulatory bodies have played a very positive role, as have the courts. So I actually think that one, purely from a regulatory and from an environment perspective, I think this is one of the best times to invest into stressed asset funds. In fact, we have gone ahead and launched a new stressed asset fund for a corpus of about 500 crores, where we're already buying assets from several of these NBFCs, from IBC and from several other ARCs, where we can complete these assets. There's enough capital available for that, and there is enough profit also available if one can start and complete projects fairly quickly. And we found great support from RERA and from the home buyers and other stakeholders who are otherwise very wary or unsure about taking these steps.
So how much money do you require to invest in these funds? I mean, the minimum amount that you require.
So if you saw the numbers that came from the Ministry of Finance when they set up the Swami Fund, they estimated almost about 900 projects are stuck.
Correct.
And almost about 80,000 homes need to be resolved.
Right.
And the capital required for that would be maybe between 3 lakh to 4 lakh crores. Yeah. However, therefore, the first 25,000 crores was considered a drop in the ocean to resolve these assets.
Right.
And therefore, Swami is not the only answer. As I said, we've started investing. We've come up with a new fund for that. Several other global players have actually entered the space and have been directly buying assets. So Apollo has picked up a basket of assets, and so many other funds have actually picked up baskets of assets to be able to complete them and fund these stressed asset portfolios. So I think Kotak has a new fund only for stressed assets, which is a $1 billion fund. So I think clearly the interest of both domestic and global investors to invest in this asset class is very high, and it's not just Swami's money of 25,000 crores, but I actually believe almost four times that amount of money, which is about a lakh of crores available. It may still be 25% of what the estimated capital is, or 33% of what the estimated capital is. But that amount of money is actually good enough to resolve bulk of the issues of projects which are viable and can be completed.
Okay.
Now, there are several projects that are unviable, where cash has been taken out. There is very little, where there's very little incentive for anybody to actually complete the project. And they've largely been siphoned off. So I think those have become more social impact sort of scenarios. And therefore, there will need to be some amount of intervention, I think, post-Swami to come up with a social impact capital pool, which, like the government is doing for bad banks, is creating a bad bank and putting all the stressed assets of financial institutions into a bad bank. I think similarly, a bad asset bank or a bad asset fund will need to be created, which is largely to cater to the impact of the home buyers without a worry for profit or return. So Swami is still not a social impact fund. It is still working for profit. It is working for return and it's got certain parameters.
Okay.
But there will need to be something which is greater than that, which will be necessary to resolve those legacy issues. And I'm hoping that in a post the success of Swami, some such fund pool is likely to be created, and a lot of thought processes underway at the central government and state government levels towards that as well.
Okay. Okay. Thanks, Abhid. Thanks for all those suggestions. And with that, we wrap up the second episode of the Money Control Real Estate Show. I'm sure our listeners would have gained valuable advice from Amit on the property market. For more tips and tricks on how to invest in real estate, tune into the Money Control Real Estate Show next week. Bye.